Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. There's so much going on the last week. We have interviewed people in Egypt. We've interviewed analysts from around the country and around the world on what's going on in the Middle East, and we will continue that conversation over the next several weeks as we watch this unfold. And we said to you, as long as the men and women were standing in Tahrir Square in Cairo, we would be talking to people from Egypt every day. And in this hour, we're talking with Americans of Arab descent, Egyptian and Iraqi descent, in our studio today, who live in our community to talk about their views of what's going on. A lot has changed in the last day. I've been reading all afternoon Al Jazeera and the Guardian newspapers, and a lot has happened. Some people are very worried at the moment that that the army is going to replace Mubarak and not allow free elections. There's some fear of that. Demonstrators are still there, but it's like throughout the Muslim world, as far away as Pakistan is from the Arab world. The prime minister fired his cabinet to start all over again, said it had nothing at all to do with rebellions happening in Egypt and Tunisia. And you see rebellions popping up in Yemen and in Algeria. And now stories about how Tunisian students were in communication with Egyptian students to talk about how to organize their own revolution in Egypt at the beginning. Iran, a demonstrator was just killed hours ago in Tehran, where people are demonstrating there. So something is bubbling beyond Egypt. And I think the United States and others around the world, in the Western world, and nations like Israel, I'm not sure what to say or do because they have no idea what's going on. Maybe nobody else does either. But I think that there's a movement happening in the world that could be as earth-shaking as the revolution of 1776 here in the United States of America. And joining us in studio today, the first person I called who helped organize the list today, Najwa Al-Amin, who's an artist who's lived in Cairo, originally from Iraq, also trained as an engineer. Mm-hmm. Najwa, thank you for agreeing to be here today and helping to organize all this.
Oh, thank you for having me here, Mark. It's a pleasure.
Sandos Awad, who is a Baltimore resident from Egypt, who we've been talking to. Sandos, welcome. Good day in the studio.
Thank you for having us.
Her daughter, Sarah Abaza, is a student at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Khalid Methwali is a dentist resident at the University of Maryland Medical School. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you for having us.
And Ahmed Garib is a student at UMBC.
Thank you for having us.
Welcome all.
Thank you.
410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation. So I think that when we talk to families in Cairo on Thursday, we talked to them immediately after Mubarak spoke. And it was interesting. I mean, the father who got on the phone, who was an ophthalmologist, his daughter and her daughter's boyfriend, both graduates of American University in Cairo, were just talking about how depressed they were. They almost didn't want to talk. And then the Friday, I talked briefly to a friend of mine who has been on the show many times, Dr. Tabat Abdallah, who now teaches at the University of Toronto, who is from Iraq originally. And Tabat said he was so happy he couldn't even talk right now. And he said, maybe next week I can talk. So that was after Mubarak had fled. Talk a bit about that. I mean, we were talking just this, I think, the overwhelming euphoria and elation.
Exactly.
Go ahead. That was felt around the Arab world, among Arabs, where they come from or live.
It's just an excitement for the future. Never felt it before. Like, I graduated from Egypt, and as soon as I graduated, like all the other students, we just feel no hope. There's no push, no motivation for the future. Now, for the first time, you kind of feel that the people are very motivated, are very excited for the future, want to really work hard for the future of Egypt and for the future of the youth. So that's really a change. I have never felt this before. All my friends from different cultures, from different backgrounds, different levels of education, we all have the push to work really hard for Egypt now. So,
Hosni Mubarak. Yep, Hosni Mubarak was there for a really long time. Most people actually hadn't seen another president,
especially your generation, never seen anything else, right?
Exactly. So, and a lot of people grew up with Hosni Mubarak as the president per se, and they didn't really. You know, it was one of those things where you knew something was wrong, but no one really had the guts to stand out and put their voice out there, because, again, there was a lot of police brutality at the time. There was secret police. There was a lot of transactions that were occurring where people weren't so sure and didn't have exactly the proof to prove their theories.
Well, I think also what happened is after his speech, everybody, we heard rumors before his speech that he's going to turn power over to the vice president. And, you know, the U.S. government was giving us those leads. And, you know, even in Egypt itself, we were hearing it from high officials that this is what he was going to do. That once he started speaking and we were all listening and we were trying to figure out what is he saying, because he really wasn't saying anything and he wasn't making sense in what he was saying. And we realized that, wait a minute, he's not stepping down. That's when we were all, I mean, we were all in shock, because the next step was going to be, okay, is it going to turn violent now because he's got all this military in the streets, or what's going to happen? And that's, I think that was the fear that night, because by the time he spoke, it was like 11:30 at night in Egypt. So people didn't sleep that night. I mean, I talked to family members who were literally crying all night because they were expecting that the next day after Friday prayers, there's going to be mass murder. You know, they were just going to start shooting all the protesters, or, you know, something's going to happen. So when we're, you know, we didn't sleep here in the United States either. We stayed up watching anything we can watch. You know, we're Skyping with family members and we're staying with them for hours. And then when we finally heard that, wait a minute, he stepped down, I think we were so much in shock that we never thought we'd see this day. You know, so that's something I didn't think I'd see in my lifetime. You know, I wish to God my father had lived to see this, because this is a day my father wanted for as long as I can remember. So the euphoria was even more because we thought it was going to be the end that day. We thought it was going to be a bloodbath. So I think that made it even more that, wait a minute, these kids were able to do it, you know, fairly blood-free. You know, it's amazing. It really is amazing. Passive resistance does work.
Najwa.
I was listening to Sundus. Sundus and I, from the older generation, the generation, our fathers fought for a day they didn't live to see. We thought we will not live to see this day. So for us, this is it's like born new. It makes us feel young, hopefully, and it gives hope for all the people who seek freedom and justice, and their lot, and not only in the Arab world, South America, and or other countries. There was a 31-year-old social worker from Paraguay on Facebook sent me a congratulation. I claimed it right away, but I said to him, I said, I'm an Iraqi, and I feel it's partially mine. Egypt is always called by all the Arab nation the heart of the Arab world. And so whatever happens in Egypt, Egypt is the heaviness of the Arab world. Population, location, everything. Plus, movies. Movies. Egypt is the Hollywood of the Arab world.
It's the heart of it. Sarah.
From a student standpoint, I've never lived in Egypt, and it's been something that I've been told, you know, Egypt is a good place to go vacation, but it's not a place you want to live. You know, they live off of $2 a day, and I don't know if I could, you know, see myself having to sacrifice that much to live in a country, but at the same time, you know, you have family there, you have history there, and, you know, today is a day where all of that can change, and, you know, one day I hope to say, you know, I can go live in Egypt and I can have the same freedoms and the same values that I have here in the United States. And, I mean, I can tell you for the last 18 days, I have been watching, you know, Al Jazeera, which has been broadcasting practically 24/7, you know, I've been watching what's been going on. We've all been to protests. Like, even though we're not in Egypt, we're supporting our people, we're supporting the change, we're supporting their rights and their freedoms.
Let me go to the phones only early because people called in and left, and some people are holding on. I really can clearly want to have them to ask at 410-319-8888. Our guests here are all in the United States, living in the United States, and are in, from the Arab American community in our community. Four Egyptians and an Iraqi. Sounds like it was the beginning of a bad poem or something. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Marina, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm well, welcome.
I have a question for the UMBC student there. Mm-hmm. I think his name is Ahmed. My understanding is there's a lot of Egyptian students at UMBC, and I'm wondering if him as a person of the Arab Student Union at UMBC, if they're promoting any kind of conversation between the UMBC students and UMBC community as in general, seeing how they are the new generation of, you know, Arabs in the United States, and I am wondering if they have any suggestions personally on what should be the next step for Egyptians as a whole.
All right. Great question, Marina. I'm currently the co-VP of the Arab Student Union at UMBC, and as a group, we actually just started, and we are actually in the formation of, in the process of actually collecting students. We had several interests in actually starting an Egyptian fund to gather some kind of fundraiser to send money over there to Egypt, some kind of like relief fund to help the people. A lot of, like, after this situation, even though it was mostly peaceful, a lot of people didn't go to work. A lot of people sacrificed, you know, money so they can stay and protect their families or so they can supply, like get enough supplies to last for months because no one at the time really truly knew how long this situation was going to last. And I truly believe that this like a type of relief would take multiple campuses, multiple Arabs from all areas, including D.C., Baltimore, Columbia, everywhere around Maryland. And there needs to be more awareness. I can't tell you how many people came to me and told me, you know, what's going on in Egypt, what's going on over there. I truly believe that right now in Egypt we're seeing a political revolution as also with the rest of the Middle East. And I think with our support here, we could help change a lot there. Thank you.
Marina, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Dwayne and Laurel. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I just have a general question. I'm trying to conceptualize the timing of what has happened in Egypt, and I'm concerned or wanting to know if it were just the events that happened in Tunisia, which kind of served as the impetus for the uprising in Egypt, or are there some other historical or political factors which decided or which caused people rather to decide that the time was now, since he has been in power or was in power for some 30 years, why now as opposed to earlier? And I'll take my response off the air.
Good question, Dwayne.
Egypt has had a lot of demonstrations over the years. They've been kind of, when the kids, or not just kids, when people demonstrated, they tend to have been beaten out of it. They've been shot at and so forth. But there have been a lot of demonstrations through the years. This is the first time that the movement actually kind of escalated. When they first were going to protest, they weren't protesting for this. They were protesting for, you know, a change in the Constitution. They were protesting for Mubarak to not run again and for her son not to run again. They were protesting so that, you know, there would be terms on president, things that, you know, they thought, well, we could probably get. They weren't expecting this to happen. So I think once it happened and they saw that it's escalating, it just took over. I think, Tuesday and Wednesday, they were fine. And then once Mubarak let the thugs out and, you know, we were seeing it live on TV where kids were being hit, things were tear gassed, and, you know, horses and camels were running in and just whacking people. All of that just escalated, and I think as a nation, people said enough is enough.
It seemed that, clearly we saw this, we began these programs just as Tunisia erupted. And we talked that day about what would happen if this spilled out over beyond Tunisia's borders into into Egypt and into surrounding countries. And then it did. And this is, it seems to me that, and I know the euphoria is still there. I mean, cannot not be. How could it not be is what I mean to say. At the same time, there are all these things you read in the papers today, in Al Jazeera and The Guardian especially, and New York Times, where they are telling the students to leave Tahrir Square or be arrested, trying to tell the workers not to strike. That people are kind of, I think, at least in Egypt it feels like, from the emails I've had today, while elated, are very nervous about what turn this is going to take, because what has happened has also begun to spread. Bahrain, Yemen, Algeria, even into Iran, even in Palestine, both in the West Bank and in Gaza. In the West Bank, they stopped demonstrations. In Gaza, Hamas is putting people in jail who attempt to demonstrate in solidarity with the Egyptians. So before we go into the other countries, what about what you're hearing from home now about and your analysis about what is going on? I mean, the very tenuous situation. Will this become a democracy? Will this become the beginnings of a military dictatorship? Can it ever really go back? Well, what are your thoughts?
I currently, from what I've heard, people are actually still, like you said, in that euphoric state, and there is a lot of feeling of hope and of change. Everyone believes that, you know, as a united group, that we can move forward. Something about Egyptians, more so than most countries, we're very nationalistic people, and not just like Egyptians, like people who were born there, but people who come visit Egypt, who come live in Egypt. Once they leave, they realize that Egyptians have a lot of pride in the way we have our country working. Kind of like you can help your neighbor just because he's Egyptian, because it's like more of whether you're truly family or not, we're all Egyptians, so we have to help each other out. So I believe that in Egypt right now, there's a big push to work together to get the fair elections, to get a new parliament in place, to get a president that's actually voted in by the people. And right now, a lot of people are questioning whether Egypt will be the next Iran, Egypt will have some kind of radical Muslim movement, or because there's a big fear of that area in the world, religious movements. And my response to that is Egypt has never actually been a radical country. More so than ever, we believe in freedom of religion. We believe in a right to follow your religious beliefs. It just turns out that a majority of our citizens are Muslim, just like in the United States, majority are Christian. It happens with different countries, but it's still... Like, Egyptians aren't – this movement wasn't started by the Muslim Brotherhood. It was started by the youth on Facebook, on Twitter, just pushing because they knew once they finished college, they had no future. So they truly wanted to change that. They wanted to have hope.
Najma, go ahead.
I think the Egyptian people are modeling for the rest of us. So we don't know where it's heading, but I think and I'm hopeful that it'll be in the right way. This is my that's what I hope for. But if I was forced to shut my mouth for 30 years, don't I have a right to say what I need? I think these people, I understand why they're out in the street asking for, their rights. Finally, they can demonstrate and say what's on their mind or what they really need, which is a simple right. So I think we will see a lot of them, and I don't think we should look like, why are they out still in the street? People, this is a process, and people are learning. If I can demonstrate peacefully and tell what I want, there's a chance that I can get some of the rights that I have. It's my country, and I'm a citizen. Mm-hmm. So I think it's normal that there would still be people who are expressing what they want.
I just want to say that, for us, we're really excited about the future of Egypt. But for the time being, we want to know what the political parties are really offering. We want to see some people coming out on state television and out on TV and saying, we are this party, and we offer this and this and that. We want people to start, political people.
Debates.
Debates. We want to see debates between people. Whoever they are, whatever they think, everyone has the right to say whatever they think and whatever they think is right for the country and for the future of the country. But we want to hear it, and we want to choose between them. So I guess the best thing is to hear Muhammad Al-Baradi, Amru Musa, Zuhail. All these people are very, people like them a lot in Egypt, but we don't know what they want to offer. Even the Brotherhood, the Islamic Brotherhood, we don't know what they want for the future, their budgets, their for education. What are you going to offer me for the future of education? We know education now is so corrupted in Egypt. How are you going to change it? How are you going to make it better? So this is going to reflect how we choose the next president or the next leaders, by debates and by people giving us their showing us what they've got to offer.
I hope that happens, Sarah.
Going off of what Dr. Khaled said, the people have finally come together and voiced their opinion. Everybody is worried what's going to happen to Egypt now. Is there going to be another, Mubarak step in place, and is a dictatorship going to continue? And that's a lot of fears that the world is having. And I truly believe that we've gotten to a point where the people of Egypt are going to push for a better democracy, a better government. They're not going to let this, 30-year rule happen again. Mm-hmm. I no doubt about it that they will not have let that happen. They've spoken. And, I mean, you can see the solidarity. They've had, I believe, at one point there was over 2 million people out peacefully protesting. So, I mean, yes, we want to know who are the political people, the figures that want to come out and say, hey, I want to step up and make Egypt better. Obviously, we want to know that. But at the same time, we realize, he's gone. It's going to be tough work from here on out. But I think the Egyptians can do it. And I think that we can hopefully rectify our government and, build back up to a great nation.
You're about to say something, Sanders.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons they're staying in Tahrir, or at least a small group wants to stay, is because for 30 years there has been no trust in the government. So now we got rid of the government, but the lack of trust is still there. So they want to stay there to remind this coming regime we're here. You're going to listen to us. You're going to make the changes we want. We're not leaving. So I think it's just more of a reinforcement for whoever's going to come, for, whoever's going to be leading the transition, that, they're not going to go back to the way it was. So I think that's the main reason they really want to stay in Tahrir. It's more of a symbolic more than anything else.
Brother, let me go to the phones here. I'll come back, have some of the questions, very specifically about the generals in Tahrir Square and the power of the army and the money they have, the investments they have, and the issues that we built around building a democracy, and also the stuff that I sent some of you. I didn't have everybody's email address, but I sent you this piece that Rami Khoury wrote in the Daily Star, which is a Lebanese paper. I said the column was, "The Arab World Gets Real on Democracy." It's a very powerful piece that he wrote. I want to talk a bit of that, too. 410-319-8888. Lamar, you're on the air.
Mark, how you doing today?
I'm well. Welcome.
I actually remember watching Anwar Sadat's funeral. I was in the third grade then, and I've always been one who I felt was savvy on U.S. and foreign relations. And I'm sad to say, but I had no idea that Mubarak had been in power for 30 years. I had no idea. And so I'm sitting here, and, for the past 10 years, I'm from the Bronx, and I actually remember when 9/11 happened. And for the past 10 years, I've been hearing all these bad things about Muslims and this and that. And then come to find out that we've actually been supporting an individual who is an apparent dictator and of the Muslim faith. So I think it now puts us at a standstill as far as our rhetoric towards Muslim countries. And ultimately, I truly believe that we're ultimately going to have to sit down with Iran
and Ahmadinejad. So it's a good thing, but I think, you know, I'm truly glad that all this came out. You know?
Yeah.
So that's it in a nutshell.
Thank you, Lamar.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think this did kind of – whatever happens next, I think this has shaken up the entire world. It's shaken up the Arab world for sure, which we can talk about right now.
Yep.
It is – it's shaken up the Middle East. It's shaken up the Muslim world. You mentioned Iran or Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Neither one of them are Arab countries, but they're mostly Muslim countries. And it's shaken up the Israelis in terms of what do they do next. I mean, I think that this could shift, I think, the entire dynamic of world politics. We've just seen occur.
That's the hope.
In Cairo. That's the hope you said.
Well, the shift is going to be to the better.
Najwa.
People, ordinary people, wherever they are, they want to have they want to live, they want to raise their kids, they want to have, bring bread by the end of the day to their tables. And I think Palestinians and Israelis have been living together.
Forever. Well, at least for the last 60 years.
I mean, you talk to Israelis and you talk to Arabs and they tell you, I don't know what the hell the governments are talking about. We're neighbors. We work together. So I think maybe it's time for the border the way we know them or the governments the way we know them to get to maybe evolve or something. Because people are communicating, and that's all you need. I mean, 10 years ago, you wouldn't know what's going on halfway around the world if you lived in Baghdad and you didn't have internet or you didn't have phones or anything. You're totally isolated. But not today. I know that there's a young man. See, we're building models here. A young man in Mosul, a 31-year-old with 4 children, and he's unemployed. He burnt himself to death.
In Mosul, in Iraq.
Right. I think it happened yesterday.
Right.
So I think, and I really hope this is going to be for a better world.
I mean, these things shifting. It's funny. We're going to go to a break here and go to Diane and Denise, the next 2 callers, and come back to our conversation with our fellow Americans, Arab Americans who are living, who joined us here today to talk about what Egypt meant, what it means to them, what it's happening from their analysis sitting here. But when you were talking about that, it made me think about how even months back I heard this group of rabbis and ministers who had just come back from Palestine and Israel. And it was really telling to me to listen to these people, especially the rabbis, because the rabbis said this was the first time they had ever going to Israel with anybody but another fellow Jew. It was the first time they saw it with different eyes. It was the first time they sat in a Palestinian store in the West Bank and had to think of things in different ways. And the ministers all said, you know, we are all always knee-jerk pro-Palestinian because it comes out of our church and that's what we believe in this thing. It's the first time we've been to the Holy Land with Jews. And they also said it made us step back and think, this is more complex and different than we think. And this human being
right.
piece that's happening was much more important than anything they had talked about before. I was really profoundly taken by that conversation. I never expected to hear it, to tell you the truth. We take a very brief break. We're going to go. Diane's the next caller, then Denise. Reintroduce our guests when we return. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. More information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555, and we will be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. And joining us in studio as we look at Egypt are four people who are Arabs living in our country, who some are citizens, some are here students, and reflecting on what's going on in Egypt, in the Middle East. Najwa Alamin, who's an artist who lived in Cairo, originally from Iraq. Sandos Awad, lives here in Baltimore, grew up in Egypt. Dr. Khalid Metawali got here just last year, right? Yeah. He's a dentist in residence, a dentist resident at the University of Maryland School of Dentistry. Ahmed Garib is a student at UMBC. And Sarah Albaza, who is the daughter of Sandos, is a student at Johns Hopkins University. 410-319-8888 is the number here. I promise to write to the phones for my next question. And so, Diane, you're on the air. Hi, Diane. You're on the air.
How you doing, Martin? Hi to your guests.
Hi. Welcome.
Hi.
I agree with the students, what they say. The only thing I don't like is when people try to take Egypt out of Africa, because it's in northern Africa. And, you know,
we don't dare.
You know, my ancestors are from Africa, and I always hold up, you know, the history, and I know the history of Egypt, and it was called different names, you know, before it was called Egypt. But I agree with you, and that's why I think a lot of the students, the protesters are staying at the square, is because they don't trust the government, and it's in its infancy stage, so, you know, somebody got to look out, because nobody looked out for them in 30 years, you know. And it's a shame that nobody did, and we as Americans, you know, we thinking everything was fine over there because they were our allies. We never had any notion that this was happening until we saw it, you know, on YouTube or Facebook, whatever. And also, you know, I heard today there's a protest in Libya. You heard about the protest in Libya. It's a small protest.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like every country, you know. And I'm just looking at it, Mark, as how God is having his work being done through the people, because we all are human. No matter what nationality, we all are human. And God wants us to live together in peace and harmony.
I agree.
And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you so much. We've had a lot of calls about the question of Egypt and Africa in the last 3 weeks we've been doing this show.
Yeah. Let me just start at saying
Khalid.
That we have a lot of problems, internal problems. So we probably need to fix our internal problems first and then start reaching to other countries like African countries and Arab countries. But let's start from Egypt. Let's make Egypt a good country, democratic, so that people, I mean, when you don't show that you're a good country and you're a democratic, you can't give advice to other countries and just say that you should do this and you should do that. So we should be leaders and then show leadership, hopefully, in the future.
Sarah.
We have the power to be good role models for other Arab countries, and I really think that that's something, you know, that if we do, you're going to see this change go throughout all of the Middle East and all of the other Arab countries. And I think that's something that if we push for democracy and we show that we can successfully carry out a government that, you know, listens to the people, then we will, like Khaled said, we will show we can be leaders and other countries will follow.
A couple of quick thoughts before we go to Denise, our next caller up. When you look at the power that's of the Egyptian army, I mean, in terms of the economic power, I mean, it controls a huge portion of the Egyptian economy, billions of dollars in money that it makes in the United States, as well as the money that comes to the United States to keep the military going in Egypt. The second biggest amount of money the United States spends on the military is in Egypt. The first is Israel. And you see that, and you see that power. And I wonder if you, just to take a clear-eyed image for a moment about what might be occurring and how the process really does change. I mean, how does democracy take hold in Egypt? I mean, it's almost hard to imagine things going back after watching what went on these last 3 weeks.
Well, I'd
rather to go Sandos. Go ahead.
I think with the army right now, it's in transition. We needed something to replace Mubarak. Right now, it's a council. It's not one person. The army is very strong in Egypt. Mubarak came from the army, and he always supported the army. But we always have to remember the army has never, ever opened fire on its own people. They've always supported the Egyptian people. So that's something that in the back of the Egyptian people's mind is the army is there to support them, which is very different from what how they feel towards police, because police in Egypt has always been against the people. So the mentality right now is very supporting of the army. So, you know, I'm hoping and I'm praying that we're heading in the right direction, that this council will, you know, carry out what they promised that they're going to carry out. But at the same time, that's the reason they're staying in Tahrir. As, you know, in the back of your mind, we're still there, and this can all start all over again.
But just notice that the people that are staying in Tahrir Square, as a matter of fact, for all of the demonstrations, it's been peaceful. I mean, the Egyptian people do not want to start problems. The only time there was violence was when the pro-Mubarak, you know, supporters came out. So even though there are protesters still in Tahrir Square, it's more symbolic than, you know, defiant of, you know, the military taking over and stuff.
Well, just to, like, to show that the Egyptian military actually can't be overstated, most of the money that the U.S. actually gives to the Egypt is supposed to be put into the military. So that's approximately, I believe, like $1.5 billion. On top of that, Egypt's GDP is usually about a 500.9. And considering that most people make about live off about $2 per, like, every day times 80 million people, that's about $1.6 billion, which still leaves a lot of room for a lot of money to go back into the country. And if you ever go to Egypt, you'll notice most of the time, a lot of the infrastructure hasn't been updated. A lot of, except for central downtown Cairo or Sharm el-Sheikh or any tourist spots, most of Egypt actually has the same infrastructure it has had since maybe the Six-Day War or since the war with Israel. Because a lot of times now, if you drive into Egypt, you'll still see buildings destroyed from the war. Nothing, no one has come out to change it. There is no public service initiated by the government. And so that has led to poor living conditions there. That other than the main, Egypt is like the middle road. It's the middle between Cairo, it's the middle between Asia, and it's also a big destination for Europeans. And now that this area, the people there are proud of our tourism, we're proud of all of that, but they also want to have their, they want to be able to provide for their families easier. They want to have jobs with meaning and, you know, a lot of times they look, when you're in Egypt, they look to America as kind of a safe haven. They see, wow, look, they have the right to vote. They can get jobs. They can be doctors. They have rags to riches essentially doesn't exist in Egypt unless you're like a soccer player or something. But in politics or money, rags to riches does not exist. And for the first time, people are fighting for that.
Then we'll go to Khalid.
I'm not sure, but I heard a report the other day, and I think it was CNN, and it was precisely about the aid of the United States to Egypt. Mm-hmm. I don't think the Egyptian government has a lot to say of how to spend that money. That money goes for buying arms from the United States. So it goes, it comes right back.
It's a circle.
But what I meant was, it's just true, but what I meant was the Egyptian army itself is a huge economic engine. I mean, it owns 15% of the Egyptian economy, everything from making shirts to whatever else is being made. So I'm saying that's a huge power in itself. And a lot of that money comes out of the U.S. And then you have the stories coming out today of more and more stories coming out about Mubarak's $30 billion, whatever it is, being dollar
wealth.
$47 billion worth of wealth. That he has stolen from the Egyptian people.
Yeah, I guess like 40% of the Egyptians live on 40% of the Egyptians live on $2 a day. While you can also see billionaires, a lot of billionaires in Egypt. So that doesn't that reflects the corruption in the government. Like you find people very very rich, and among the Arabs are rich, but we have even richer Egyptians. So. That's the first thing. The second thing, you can find the public services in Egypt. There's nothing spent on them. It's just they tell you we spend like $40 billion on the public services, on public. But you can't really see anything. You can't really
like people are still tired of traveling with the public services. Mm-hmm. Like I've tried it once or twice, and then that's it. I'm never doing it again. And it's been years and years and years. And every other election, whatever it is, it's just people talking about some things, but nothing really physically. You can't really touch anything. The second thing, I really think that the military, the head of the military, Mohammed Tantawi, who's the head of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, he's a respectable man. People do like him in person. Other ministers and other ministries, the people that head the ministry itself, they're corrupted. People know they have billions and billions in Swiss banks. They have cars all over the place. Their kids are just spending money in every place. So we know that they're corrupted. So we need to remove and actually have a law that people can see that how these corrupted people can really be justified and it can go to justice. That's it.
I mean, in Egypt, it's said like 70 or 80% of the wealth is in less than 5% of the population.
Since the United States.
So that's a sad statement right there.
And one of the things that strikes me about all this is over and over when I think about what's going on in Egypt, is that of all the places on the earth, Egypt is one of the few places where people actually have a consciousness of being a people that is thousands of years old, thousands and thousands of years old, called Egyptians. Mm-hmm. Think about that in terms of where we are in the 21st century and what just occurred in Egypt and the role that plays in all this, the sense of nationhood, the sense of peoplehood, the sense of place that many people cannot put their fingers on this globe.
Something about us, we are, our history is, it has more meaning than words can state. For example, like after everything that happened, you know, we knew what was happening in Tahrir. We know about the protest. But me personally and like members of my family, we were extremely hurt by more than anything when people tried to loot from the museum, because we felt that while, yes, everything is important, we love to hold on to our history, and we couldn't believe that someone would call themselves Egyptian and actually try that. And what was really amazing was after that happened, people stood outside to protect it more than anything. They risked their lives for artifacts just because it was our story. It was our past.
That's right. The protesters, when they burned the NDP building, I think that's like adjacent to the National Cairo Museum. Mm-hmm. The protesters formed a chain around the museum to protect it. And it goes to show that, you know, this uprising, they did not do it to cause damage to their country. You know, no other buildings other than the governmental buildings, which, you know, housed all of the corrupted leaders, were the only ones damaged. In terms of, you know, people were protecting their homes from looters and the people that escaped from prison. It just goes to show that we love our country and all of the history and the antiquities that it owns. And, I mean, despite everything going against the government, they did try and protect it. And I think that if I read correctly, only, like, I think two mummies were damaged.
Yeah, nothing was stolen.
But nothing like, big happened to the museums. And while that's sad, it's a really good thing that they were able to protect it until the military stepped in. Because that's thousands of years of history.
I think there's six or eight pieces are missing.
Right, and some of the folks thinking that wasn't.
That wasn't the
demonstrators.
That wasn't the demonstrators.
Probably not.
No.
This is maybe a silly question, but Tahrir. Mm-hmm. What does Tahrir mean in English? Because everywhere I look, there's a Tahrir
Liberation.
Square.
Liberation.
Liberation. Liberation. It was a Tahrir Square in every country where
even
students
Tehran.
Right.
Even mm-hmm. in Tehran.
Where students are gathering. Yeah. Young people are gathering. So I was thinking, mm-hmm. Okay.
That's Tahrir from the colonies era. Mm-hmm. Colonial era.
So in watching what's going on here, we've just heard that Mubarak was alleged to have a stroke after he got to...
Yeah, supposedly he's in and out of a coma.
In and out of a coma.
That's the rumor, that he's in and out of a coma. He suffered a stroke. But we don't know for sure he's in Sharm. There are a lot of rumors going around in Egypt that he's in the Emirates. There were rumors going around that he was supposed to go to Germany. we're not quite sure where he is.
When you look at the next few days and few months and what's ahead, I'm really curious what you all are going to look out for. What are the signs that you are going to watch for in terms of the hope you have for what could come next?
Well, first of all, I need to know what the past, the government, all the corruption, everything is going to come out now. Everything, all the people that stole money, that did the bad, all these things, the past 30 years, I want to know what they did. And I want to know, because this is going to show us in the future. We should learn from these. And then I need to all the political parties to really give us, show us what they got. Debates. I want to see debates between people, between different political parties. And people to join, and youth and teenagers giving their opinions. Everyone should join this, the future of Egypt. And each and every Egyptian, even if you're living outside of the states, outside of Egypt, in Egypt, different cities.
Go ahead, Susan.
Well, I think the first thing we're going to start seeing, or I hope we're going to start seeing, is some kind of, you have to hold people responsible for what they did. And I hope that that happens. I hope a lot of these ministers that have robbed Egypt blind are held responsible. And I think once you start that, it is going to show people that, wait a minute, we're trying to get rid of corruption, because corruption is rampant in Egypt. We need to get the money back. I mean, supposedly the wealth of Mubarak can pay off the country's debt. And that's sad, when... And that's just one family. So you can imagine all the other families that have been robbing Egypt blind. So there has to be accountability. And I want to see that. And I think that, to me, will be a right step. And I agree with Khaled. Then we need to start seeing parties. We need to start seeing, and I don't mean by parties, where the wealthy are going to put money in a certain party to kind of get what they want. I don't want to see that. So we need transparency of what's behind the parties, who's behind the parties, who is, who's willing to run for office. We have a lot of highly intelligent people that can take over Egypt.
Maybe there will be new parties.
And that would be great. That's what
Maybe
I hope.
Maybe
there
will be
for.
New.
Yeah. That's my hope.
I mean, on a positive note, a couple more things I'm thinking about. Oh, we only have a few minutes left. Is that saying we're over? No, go ahead. Misunderstood. That says rap already. Not really rap. One of the scenes that really struck me before this happened that led to a scene in Tahrir Square was there's this great picture of demonstrators holding up two people, somebody holding a Quran and someone else holding a Coptic cross,
right.
Yes. As they're in the middle of the square. Mm-hmm. And it made me think of when the Coptic church was blown up, and the following day thousands and thousands of Muslims came to the church, mm-hmm. to protect the church and to go into the church. Mm-hmm. That said a great deal about the sensibilities of Egyptians that we don't always read or hear about, because we have this simple idea in the West.
Well, you know what also happened at Tahrir Square is when Muslims were praying, Christians were protecting them.
Yeah. Right.
When the Christians were praying, the Muslims were protecting. That sent the signal out that, wait a minute, we don't have the problems that these governments are claiming we have. It's more governments creating the problems to get financial aid from overseas or to keep, we've had martial law now in Egypt for 30 years, and that was one of the reasons. It's supposedly because, we've had problems between Christians and Muslims. But when you come down to it, this showed that we really don't.
No.
That people are working together, and that to me was just – that made me cry the first time I saw it, I'll be honest with you.
On a more political note, the problem with people had with the U.S. Telling Mubarak to step down – was a lot of political strategists believed that maybe, they were less concerned with the humanity of the situation, more concerned of Israel's well-being, more concerned of how we would cooperate with the U.S. afterward. And a big thing to represent that in Egypt was this showed that Egypt has no intention of becoming a theocracy. anywhere near like Iran. I believe right now in the Middle East, you're having a democratic revolution, much like what happened in Italy after World War II, much what happened in Germany after World War II. People are tired of not having their voice, and they want to show the world that we are strong, but we do not want to push our will upon others. We want just to enjoy our lives and have the basic sensible needs.
I mean, whatever would happen here, it seems to me that this is difficult. It's a difficult tap to turn off once it's been turned on.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
I may be more jaundiced than most people in this room about power and politics and where the world's going. We'll wait and see what the Egyptian military does and the power of money and the billions of dollars happens and how much freedom really comes. And my hope is that it does come.
I hope so.
On the other hand, what's been turned on here is something that no one ever expected to see.
Mm-hmm.
And it really has changed the consciousness of not just the Arab world and the Muslim world in general, but I think the entire world.
I mean, it was really funny because after what happened in Tunisia, it was really awkward because, you know, we watched it on TV and we're like, wow, this is amazing. Imagine if it happened to us. Like, my own mother was like, Abel Masr, which in Arabic means, soon Egypt's turn will come. And even though we said that and it was in our hearts that we hoped it,
you didn't expect it.
It was total shock. And
not in 18 days.
Yeah. We just like so much uncertainty and so much, I don't know. I truly believe that they showed the world today that not everything is done through violence.
I mean, Tunisia was, you know, the inspiration, I think, which I think that was like, you know, the match on the haystack that got it going. And now so many other countries are saying, wow, Egypt, this big country, this very populous country, you know, now did the same thing. There's like when protesting, you know, they had a saying, you know, yesterday Tunisia, today Egypt, tomorrow who's going to be the next country? You know, it's kind of like a domino effect.
Well, you saw one of the things you saw was it was an interesting story about the Facebook conversations between Tunisian students and Egyptian students before this started. And Egyptian students actually saying, tell us what you did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you do this? And the way they organized it by saying we're going to be in one place, but we didn't go to that place and went to another place instead. And how these college-educated Egyptian students went into the poorest community in Cairo, and then they ended up with – they walked in with 50 people and walked out with 5,000. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty phenomenal.
There was lots of Tunisian students commenting on Facebook, telling the people in Egypt like how to handle tear gases, what to wear, what to do, the amount of food you have to have. Like, it actually brought all the Arabs together. We had some kind of like for the past years, to be honest, Arabs weren't really liking each other. This really brought them back together, and it really shook up any corrupted government, whatever it is.
Because their dignity was crushed.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, I remember seeing pictures over there and even here, the Egyptian flag and the Tunisian flag, you know, half and half.
Yeah.
We wish we had more time. We have to break right now and go to our next subject. I want to thank you all for being here. This has been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you for having us.
Great fans.
Najwa Amin, thank you so much. Always good to see you. Sundar Sawad, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Khalid Metawali, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Ahmed Gharib. And Sarah Abaza,
thank you very much.
And as my friend Suni Khalid, his teacher and father in Egypt, who is Mohammed Sid Ahmed, and he asked me to dedicate this program to him, a man who fought for the liberation of Egypt and would love to have been alive today to see this take place. We'll be right back. Stay with us.